Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
I should probably lead with this one. So here's the headline. NIH scientists have a fresh new cancer breakthrough, but layoffs are delaying its implementation. And that's just not okay. Scientists at the NIH demonstrated a promising step towards using the patient's own immune cells to fight gastrointestinal cancers, one of the most common kinds of cancers, in a paper in Nature Medicine on Tuesday. The same day, well, I guess this is about a week and a half old, the same day, things move so fast, my God. It's the same day that the agency was hit with devastating layoffs that left many NIH personnel in tears and many labs in crisis. This treatment, CAR T-cell therapy, is still early in its development. It's a personalized immunotherapy regimen that is truly breakthrough medicine. It shrank tumors in only a quarter of the patients with colon, rectal, and other GI cancers in this clinical trial. But this is remarkable because they highlight a path to a very frustrating, elusive goal in medicine, which is harnessing the person's own immune system to target common solid tumor cancers. Now, this CAR T-cell therapy was originally developed, and by the way, the CAR T-cell, CAR is for chimeric antigen receptor, and essentially what it means is that you take the person's own T-cells out of their body, and then you process them, a process that can take weeks or even months, to attack two things, really. One is that they will now attack a specific antigen that only the cancer cells make. So it's very targeted therapy. And because they're T cells, they can get into the solid tumors. Previously, this type of therapy has only been done with malignant melanoma, which was the first one. In fact, it's pretty amazing. But it's also been done in leukemia and lymphoma. And the reason for that is because those are blood cancers and the cells live in the bone marrow. And there's a lot of, and it's everywhere they are, lymph nodes, bone marrow, there's lots of blood. So the blood is getting in there, therefore the cells are getting in there. But when you talk about the center of your liver, getting it out of the blood and into the liver tissue, well, that takes special training and a special kind of cell. The other thing they do is they also make these T cells effectively immortal because they retrogress them to being sort of semi-demi stem cells themselves. It's amazing what we can do. And different lines of research, all of it funded, almost all of it funded, at least partly by the American taxpayer, are finally coming to a point where we have the power to really build the therapy personalized to the individual and personalized to the cancer. This is very, very exciting. But progress arrives at a very sad time here, this progress in particular, because the work is slowing down. Two patients' treatment who were in the study using the experimental therapy had to be taken out of the study because the NIH's capacity to make their personalized cell therapies had been slowed by the firing of highly skilled staff and by purchasing slowdowns. And these had occurred even before the major layoffs that just took place. The quality of care at NIH Clinical Center, the country's largest research hospital, is excellent. But the Trump administration's aggressive downsizing of staff and hampering of routine activities is beginning to delay that care. Rosenberg, the researcher in charge of this study, says, "Everything I try to do, I try to do at warp speed. These are people with desperate illnesses and nowhere to go. Right now, assuming things don't get any bit worse, it could be a month delay. And these are patients that may not have that many months left. Natalie Phelps of Bainbridge Island, Washington, is one of those who can't wait. The 43-year-old mother of two learned 5 years ago that GI symptoms her doctors had attributed to her second pregnancy were actually caused by colorectal cancer. Again, just a few weeks ago, we talked about the dramatic upsurge of aggressive colorectal cancer in people younger than the usual age where you see it historically. Well, since then, Natalie has been through pretty much any hell I can go through, as she puts it. An 18-hour surgery to remove her tumor, radiation to her brain, 3 liver surgeries, 48 rounds of chemotherapy, and still, this cancer has spread throughout her body. Now, I want to break topic and go off on a tangent for one thing and say, if a person starts out a pregnancy with a hidden malignancy, this is very, very bad, or can be, because the fetus is effectively a foreign body. And so the immune system down-regulates. The immune system is suppressed in certain ways, particularly T-cell immunity during pregnancy. That's one of the reasons that pregnant women are at such high risk for complicated COVID. And of course, it makes so much sense to stop vaccinating them. Words fail me. But we see this where a woman has the baby and then within a year or two, an aggressive, already metastasized cancer is discovered. So this fall, Natalie showed up at NIH in Bethesda, had 2 days of intensive testing, and qualified for one of Dr. Rosenberg's trial. She was overjoyed. It made her feel so proud to see the NIH, she said. It's a beautiful building and everything managed so professionally in a way that I hadn't experienced at any healthcare institute around the country. The NIH is the jewel in the crown, and we're going to pry it out and put in a, zirconia, but that's effectively, you know, not the same. In 2017, the first drug in a transformative new class of medicine was approved to treat these blood cancers. Last year, a different type of cell-based immunotherapy was approved for melanoma that has spread to other parts of the body. And these tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes are cloned and expanded, and the numbers are increased. And then, as I said, they're trained to go after the tumor. So Rosenberg and colleagues first used these tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes using a method that worked for melanoma and GI cancers that had spread. It didn't work. Their first try didn't work. The second try, they got a little bit better. This time, 3 out of 39 tumors shrank. The last try, they found one. Pembrolizumab, it takes the brakes off the immune cells. And right now, this new study is raising eyebrows all over the oncology world because it involves solid tumors. But they lost 2 scientists involved in the specialized process that requires months of training in preparing the cells for the patient's treatment. Oh, they were probationary. Doop, they're gone. By fiat, right? With no consideration and no recourse, no appeal. 9 highly skilled scientists also on the team will need to be renewed in at the end of this year, and there's no insurance they will be renewed. And we're going to have more people not getting therapy that is truly life-saving. Also, these cuts have affected the spread of clinical knowledge. Doctors go to conferences to attend verbal presentations of research that are presented in a lecture format. These lectures and these events are super important. Somebody gives a talk, you go up to them afterwards, you tell them about your research, and a new collaboration is born. That can't happen on a Zoom. It also can't happen by reviewing the proceedings of the trial. And that is not the trial, the proceedings of the talk. And that is just the key serendipity that makes American research so powerful, is the interconnections and partnerships that are formed. This is why businessmen go to conferences, go to business meetings, is to make connections. And it's a vital part of research. The number of people capable of purchasing materials has plummeted because it's harder and more difficult to obtain critical supplies. So they haven't been able to work as quickly because they haven't been able to get the reagents. I remember during COVID when our supply chain for things like swabs collapsed and viral culture medium, and we couldn't do COVID PCR tests because we didn't have the storage to do the swab. And then when we finally started synthesizing up at UC Santa Cruz, was one of the places that started bringing forward reagents so that we could do the culture, the viral culture medium. But we didn't have the right swabs, and it took a while before anybody sourced the swabs. So we had the stuff to swab the noses, but we didn't have the swabs. How crazy is that? Okay, this is, as I said, just nuts. All right. I see a little buzzer going, so we're going to pick up that call. Hello, you're on the air. This is Dr. Motika. What's your name?
Hello, Dr. Motika. This is Bob. I saw my dermatologist 2 days ago, and I was a little concerned about these things up near my forehead on each side. And I asked him, so what's the deal here? Are these precancerous? No, they're what we call, and of course he gave me a long name. And I wondered, well, now what if I were to scratch it open? If it's not cancerous, would I invite a cancer cell to fill in the little cavities? It would be sort of like having a scab. And there are two of them. I know you're not giving advice, but how do you think about this?
Well, you know, you can't diagnose on the radio.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give you an educated guess for starters, which I am allowed to do. This is pure speculation.
Yeah.
But one of the common things that shows up on people's foreheads and on their nose and things like that is something called a seborrheic keratosis.
Uh-huh.
And guys are, and they look kind of like somebody did a spit wad with dark brown paper, and it's sort of sitting there. So it's like got a crumpled up, almost cobblestone-y appearance. It's very rough to the touch, and it's raised, and it has what is classically called a stuck-on, like someone slapped it on and it's stuck. It's flat, usually maybe a dome, but it's got a very sharp border and very different from the surrounding skin, and it isn't particularly red or irritated or scaly.
Right.
So if it's one of those are very recognizable. They're always benign, so we don't have to worry about them. And they are an aging change. They do tend to show up in sun-exposed areas, but they're benign, and we don't even have to freeze them. You can pull it off with your finger, and it'll be just like if you scratched a hole in yourself. If you with respect to your cancer cell question, it's not that you invite the cancer cells in. It's just that when you force tissue to heal over and over and over again, you increase the chance of a typographical error. And if it's a sun-exposed area, well, there's probably already a few typographical errors from ultraviolet radiation hitting that skin.
Uh-huh.
And so you might think of it as a bingo card. You've got three across, and do you really want to go for four? And so repeatedly traumatizing the area, and we do see in certain occupations where there is recurrent and repetitive trauma to a certain area, whether it's from ultraviolet light, back of the neck on a farmer, for example, or whether it's because a strap or some apparatus, perhaps the person wears a prosthetic leg, and there's rubbing and recurrent trauma. And just like you'll get a callus on the bottom of your feet, especially if you draw blood in the skin area, that chafing can be an area with a statistically increased risk of cancer.
So I wish I'd written down that long phrase he left. And if you say it's subcutaneous keratin.
No, seborrhea. So
seborrhea.
S-E-B, oh God, 1B, I think, O-R-H, E-I-C, and that's not right, and I've just been washed out of the spelling bee, but Google but Google to the rescue if you manage that, even anything close to that spelling. And then keratosis, I can spell. It's K-E-R-A-T-O-S-I-S.
Not so, like halitosis, though, huh?
Well, not as stinky, but possibly just as embarrassing.
Oh, the first word, Seborrhea.
Or seborrheic, but okay, yeah. If you put seborrhea keratosis in your little browser, the Boolean search will find it.
Well, as I say, the stuff, the two of them, one's bigger than the other, but they look like moles. So when were they there? So one is supposed to take care of moles, make sure they don't go cancerous or aren't already.
Right, you take them to the dermatologist, and the dermatologist takes a glance at them and says, okay, we're going to biopsy that. Or we're going to burn that or freeze that off or don't worry about it.
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
Forget about it. So I don't know which of the three, but I'll tell you that the odds favor, just from the location and the fact that they're symmetric, that you have them on both sides and kind of on the temple, it's a very common place to get them.
Huh. Well, I wear hats and all the time, so I wondered, well, anyway, sunlight creeps in, huh?
Sunlight. And, yep, and when you were a child, you probably were not quite so judicious about your headwear.
That's for sure. So I'm going back to drink a case of Jack Daniels and get rid of them like that.
No, you know what? No, what you should actually do is rub a page from the Bible on them and then wad it up and then wait for a full moon and then bury it under a rock.
Dr. Kennedy, you're a breakthrough scientist. I wish I knew you better. Okay, well, thanks for riding it out on this, and I'll just take a look and keep on going. Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Bye. There are two R's in seborrheic keratosis, S-E-B-O-R-R-H-E-I-C. Thank you for that, Charles from Watsonville. Let's go to an email. This is from Mike Quimson in the Philippines. Yay, the Philippines. That's the first time I've gotten a letter from the Philippines. I can put a little pin in my world map. I came across this info and just want to know your thoughts about it. Is there truth and why not on mainstream cure procedure for cancer patients with Joe Tippin's cancer cure protocol? I did have to look up Joe Tippin's. And this is what I found. I found a very interesting article about Joe Tippin's story. This is a story that has been all over the internet and YouTube. It took off in South Korea and led to a national shortage, a bit like what happened with during COVID, ivermectin, right? Everyone was like, oh, ivermectin, the anti-parasite drug, we can take it and it's going to keep us from getting COVID. And the CDC was saying, well, you know, you really shouldn't take like large doses of that all the time or every day or for prevention, because the way it's normally used for parasites, it's like given on one for a week and then one more time 10 days later, and then that's that. And we know it can damage the liver and overdose, and probably taking it every day might be a problem. You shouldn't go there because it doesn't work. That was the CDC's stance on it. And of course, no one believed them because, hey, YouTube. Anyway, I'm not going to touch the ivermectin issue, but in this case, it's an example of where social media pushes something that may not have the scientific legs that it needs to. In the case of the Joe Tippin's cure, this was the claim of an American cancer patient that he was cured by a drug called fenbendazole, and this was a patient with lung cancer, and he was also drug and his cancer went away. The problem is he was also at the time a participant in the Keytruda clinical trial at MD Anderson Cancer Center. So he was on a state-of-the-art biological anti-cancer drug and his cancer went away. But of course, he thought it was the anti-parasite drug rather than this. And he went on it on the air with that. It went viral. And I don't know if there was a financial thing or he was sincerely delusional, but whatever it was, it went crazy in South Korea. And so this is in about 2018 that it goes viral in South Korea, and suddenly the pharmacies are being sold out on this anti-parasitic drug. And people were very interested in it. There was a famous comedian in Korea who said on Facebook or on social media somewhere that he was taking it for his lung cancer. And in about September of 2019, he tried to, he announced it on September of 2019. And a year later, he basically recanted because his cancer had continued and he died a year later. There's no evidence that this stuff works. But the reason I'm even going into such details is because I found a research paper written by some Koreans, National Cancer Control Institute, Goyang, South Korea, and lead author Ji-hyun Kim. And they basically said they did focus group interviews and they wanted to figure out how people were informed based, you know, how did they get their information? Had they heard about this drug? Yes, they all had. And they were all 50 years or older, so on the older side, and they were curious about how the information diffuses and thought this was interesting. And this paper was published in, 2022, so quite recently. And their main point is that the information you get on the internet cannot be relied upon and needs to be validated. And so I would say to our friend in the Philippines, you know, the problem is very, very clear. You can't believe everything you hear. It's sort of like when the guy with the medicine thing, you know, the medicine wagon that's got the bottles of, you know, the Kickapoo oil that's going to, you know, cure cancer, cure baldness, good for what ails you. And, you know, they have a little person come up on stage, is all weak and arthritic, and they drink the stuff and they start doing jumping jacks. And enough people buy that they go and buy the Kickapoo oil, which, by the way, being high in alcohol, has at least some economic value. And, you know, hey, it might work and I'm kind of desperate and the doctors can't do anything for me, so why not give it a try? Well, there's reasons. So I thought I'd put out a warning about this B6 toxicity issue. I've had two patients recently tell me that they are toxic, that they are toxic on B6. And what happened was, I don't know why doctors, there must have been some information so that went out that I missed the memo about checking B6, or the labs changed and now they're looking at B6, because we don't typically test for B6, but several people perfectly well with no symptoms of neuropathy have been told that they're, oh my God, toxic on B6. One of these was a patient of mine who has a mutation in their B12 and they actually need to take higher dose methylated B12, and if they don't, they suffer essentially the symptoms of pernicious anemia, which is where your body is unable to absorb B12. So I was curious about this, and then I went and did some fishing on the internet, and what I came across was, oh yeah, B6, you have to have been fasting for 12 to 18 hours before you get your blood drawn. So I called up the two patients and I said, hey, by any chance, do you take your vitamins every day? Oh, yes, doctor, I'm very good about taking my vitamins. Okay, well, you probably don't have a toxic B6. What you probably have is a normal post-dosing spike of B6, because they didn't, as I said, have any of the symptoms of B6 toxicity. So if you get this call from your doctor about your B6 is too high or you're taking multivitamins, the answer is, yes, I am, and I took it before the test, and I'll stop taking it for for 48 hours and let's repeat the test before we get worried about this. But of course, who knew, right? And I also want to tell you another one that you probably don't know, and that is biotin. Now, biotin is a B vitamin, and it's often given in very high doses for hair loss or thinning of the hair or weak nails. And so lots of people take really high doses of biotin. The doses we're talking about are like 5 milligrams of 10 milligrams. I've even seen 15 milligrams of biotin. And my advice to you is if you're taking one of those, be aware and write this down because your doctor probably doesn't know it and it could kill you, all right? It's not that your biotin level is toxic. It's that the biotin screws up a bunch of lab tests. See, there's a technique called biotin streptavidin technique, and I have no idea what that is, but if the lab is using this particular technique to check your tests for a bunch of things, it's going to be off if you're on regular high-dose biotin. So most of it, well, it's hormones, and that includes vitamin D. So if you are on high-dose biotin, I can't trust your vitamin D level. You have to be off it for 72 hours. So from now on, I need to be really sure that I tell all of my thyroid patients that because it throws off thyroid levels. So I might get a really weird case where a person's thyroid level is really low, but their TSH is normal, and I'm going to think they have a brain tumor. Or I'm going to find that their thyroid level is really high and their TSH is normal. And then I'm going to think they have a different problem. And it throws off estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, and cortisol if you're taking this high-dose biotin. And they use that biotin streptavidin technique. And here's the real rub on this. Troponin, the thing that we test when you show up in the emergency room with chest pain, it throws off troponin. So it might cause, you might be actually having a heart attack and they send you home with Mylanta because you have a normal troponin and your EKG, you have what's called a non-ST elevation MI. So you have an MI that hasn't affected your EKG. It's a real MI. It can affect your heartbeat and kill you or put you into sudden death or cardiac arrest when you go home, but you're going to have a normal troponin and they're probably going to send you home. So what are we going to do? We're going to tell the doctor we're on high dose biotin, have them put that in the lab comments on the order that they send to the lab. And there's always a comment section, high dose biotin. The lab chemists can use a different method, but this is a commonly used method. So if this is a troponin and you're in the ER and they're using that test, well, like I said, it could cause dire consequences. So let's just stay out of that. And we have a caller. Hello, caller. Hello. And what's your name and where are you calling from?
My name's Richard. When you came on, you mentioned you had been listening to the program right before you. So it's really important to announce who you're talking to. And I missed that was the program before yours was very interesting, but I didn't get the name of the person she was interviewing.
I just listened for the last 15 minutes myself. He was very articulate and passionate and I thought inspiring. And I don't remember his name. Names are not my strong suit. And there's no documentation here at the station. Do you have access to the internet? Can you go online?
No.
All right. What you would want to do is go to the library and have the librarian bring you to ksqd.org. Just tell her the name of the radio station. And when you get to the station, there's a station guide, and you can find all that information out by just going back to today's date. And I'm sure the library, you know, those poor librarians in the computer section, they're just, you know, sitting there kind of waiting, just waiting for someone to need them. So you could do her a favor and yourself one by figuring that out. And then you might be able to even just put on some headphones and listen to the whole program. But you can certainly get the name of the person.
Okay, great. Thank you. You gave me a very articulate answer.
Well, I try. I love the libraries. My local library is the Watsonville Library on Main Street, and the building is beautiful. They have children's events. They have story hours. They have craft meetings. I mean, it's the equivalent of like a Grange or a community center. They have a little historical museum. Libraries just are amazing institutions, and we've gotten so seduced by the internet that we've forgotten the joy of tripping over something we didn't know we wanted to know about that wasn't delivered to us by an algorithm, but just by fate. So I heartily encourage everyone to take a moment this summer and set yourself up at the library, explore the building, see what they've got. They're wonderful places.
Is it on Main Street?
Well, I'm in Watsonville, so that's the one I go to. But the Santa Cruz Public Library System has lots of libraries. There's one in Live Oak. There's one in downtown. Lots of opportunities. Well, there you go. So they will be able to help you with your, and maybe even they have an internet class, because you know that this is a skill for the modern age that you really probably at least want to have the basics. Because
computer screens drive me nuts, and websites and things. You know, I'm a person.
I know for people who have impaired vision, there are computers that will read to you. There's voice command now, so you can, with a little bit of training, you can tell it what to do, and it'll do it like sort of your own library Alexa. But
you said that. The librarian will be overjoyed to have somebody to help.
Yes, she will, or he. I guarantee it.
So I'll rely on what the librarian tells me.
All right.
I'm not going to look at that damn computer screen.
Okay, this is a man who's determined to stick it out. All right, sir, I respect your determination. Go you. All right, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, so Grinch, right? We're going to talk about the Grinch that stole children's bedtime. Well, actually, the Grinch in this case is a hormone that has now showed up in children's medicines, gummies, and all over the place. And no, we're not talking about CBD, which being a neurotransmitter is effectively a hormone. We're talking about melatonin. There are all these melatonins for kids out there now. This starts out with a Danish neuroscientist who researches melatonin, and she was visiting Rhode Island, and she went into a shop and saw all these, you know, pebbles and bam bam melatonin things. And in Denmark, this is a prescription medication only for adults. That they're only prescribing it to children who have really severe developmental disorders, and it clearly has not been studied in children, which is why it's so controlled in Denmark. But this is happening outside of traditional healthcare. Most pediatricians do not know that the children are being given melatonin, and it's not just now and then. 30 years ago, few people were giving melatonin to children outside of maybe a few experiments, but it has become more popular in the 90s. A lot of the labels said, do not give them to younger people, particularly babies. By the mid-2000s, there were news reports basically saying that people were adopting it earlier and early. And so reports came out saying, you know, use it for kids who are 11 and up, but it's being used just like a vitamin. Usage is growing among toddlers, and as many as 1 in 5 preteens now take melatonin at least occasionally, and there are some younger children consuming it multiple times a week. This is a hormone that you're giving to young children, and there's no long-term research on this. Once in a while, maybe, but in a 2021 journal article, a professor at physiology in Australia showed that melatonin binds to receptors all over the body, a pancreas, heart, fat tissue, and reproductive organs. And those puppies, man, those are in development. I would not be wanting to throw hormones. I mean, we're having this big controversy about puberty blockers. Well, this is the opposite. And we know that we have precocious puberty now because of phthalates, and some of the microplastics are giving people periods younger and younger. In fact, this guy Kenaway actually had a patent on a veterinary drug that used melatonin to boost fertility in sheep. This is a vast, uncontrolled medical experiment, and children are not like adults. Their bodies are still going through many transitions that are guided by hormone signaling. Now, there's in the United States in the early 20th century, parents used to sometimes give laudanum to help young children sleep. That turns out to be that laudanum is liquid opium. Years later, people started giving the kids their Benadryl to help them sleep. Now, once in a while on a plane ride, sure. But when a child takes a one milligram dose of melatonin, it quickly goes to the brain, signaling that it's time to sleep. But the melatonin levels that are achieved in the blood when you take a pill can be more than 10 times higher than natural peak concentrations in children. And because the brain is still under development, we really can't imagine what that could possibly do. Is melatonin a natural supplement? Well, maybe, but I'm not thrilled with the idea of giving gummies to children to make them sleep, among other things, you know, tooth decay. But the advertising here is also kind of a free-for-all, and the products make it's just the same problem with some of the marijuana products, or some of the cannabis products, I should say, where you make them so attractive that the kids aren't just going to stop with one. I mean, I remember climbing up to the top shelf. I was probably 5, and I really liked the taste of St. Joseph's baby aspirin. And I figured out how to pry off the childhood safety cap with a butter knife, and I could get the cap off just by twisting the butter knife. And you could buy 100 baby aspirin. That's 80 milligrams. If I had taken the entire bottle of baby aspirin, I very well might have ended up in the emergency room again for an aspirin overdose, which is one of the more common fatal overdoses. And I will also add that this would have been my second trip for the emergency room, because once my mama left her purse on the floor and I got into it and ate all of her diet pills, which fortunately were bright blue. But the poison control centers for melatonin ingestion, where the kids have gotten a hold of the whole bottle, has gone up 530% between 2012 and 2021. And mostly the kids get drowsy, right? But what we don't know, and what we are not studying, is what happens to those children in high school, in college, with their fertility. There was a crib death. A 3-month-old girl had died in her crib. They found 20 different bottles of melatonin in the house, and they investigated, and they found that the girl had been given 5 milligram doses of melatonin multiple times per day to help them sleep. Did that kill this baby? We don't know. It could have been an ordinary crib death, but it's very scary to think that that could have happened. It's one of those situations where the precautionary principle is called for, and the supplement industry has really taken a step too far here with declaring that this is harmless in children. Any functional medicine doctor worth the piece of paper that they got from taking their boards would think twice about giving hormones to children. And part of the controversy about giving hormones to children or stopping puberty in children is we don't really have a, this is only done until very recently for clinical indications where the, where it was, is done for a limited time or it was done very specifically. And those individuals were not followed up on. We really don't even know what happened to people who, with precocious puberty, who got puberty blockers at 20 years later. There needs to be a systematic research project funded by the NIH, so don't hold your breath, which goes out and finds the people. Of course, you'll have to do it in Europe because we have no idea what someone was given in their childhood. We do not have a integrated record system. My God, in Finland, they can go back to 1946 and tell you what drugs were given to whom for what. And that's where we find out about the late side effects of drugs in countries that have a registry. Imagine the power of that that national drug registry given our population if, well, it, back in the early 1990s, when it was proposed as part of national health care, that it, that had been that that had gone through, or in the early 2000s when HIPAA was produced, if that had gone through, and I was part of the group that went, you know, that went to Washington and demanded that they do that, and they didn't. And all I can say is that this needs to stop. If you or your grandchild or your niece or your nephew is getting daily melatonin, stop. Find something else. Read them to sleep. Take the melatonin yourself. I don't know, but don't keep giving this to kids. We just can't be sure that it's safe for that developing brain, those developing reproductive organs, and for that matter, the developing heart and the developing liver. And it has to be proven safe if you're going to give it to kids. So it seems like I am busting iconoclasts, and I've got I'm being an iconoclast, so I'm busting icons. 5 minutes about food expiration date. So I mentioned the COVID thing. Part of the problem was that the health department wouldn't use expired swabs. Now, what was expiring in that package was not the swab. What was expiring was the viral culture medium. That makes sense. They should have been recycling the swabs on, rather than telling us to throw the kits out, which is exactly what they did. I didn't. I held on to the swabs, and later on they called me and said, hey, do you still have those swabs? And I'm like, yeah, I'll drop them off, because I'm a bit of a hoarder. So it's reminds me of a quote. It's not mainly the things you don't know that get you into trouble. It's the things you do know for sure that just ain't so. Well, in the case of food labels, we waste about a third of our food. It comes to 3 billion pounds. That's seven of food annually. That works out to 7 billion in losses. And it's because we believe these little fortune cookie stamps on our food. Now, what happens if you use something about after the printed weight? Nothing. Okay. Most shelf-stable goods will physically degrade, and they'll separate, or they'll obviously not look like they're supposed to look. Flavors and colors may fade. Old almonds won't be overrun with bacteria. They won't kill you, but they'll taste off because their oils have broken down and become oxidized. Acidic dairy products such as yogurt and sour cream, those they're not going to get bacterial contamination. They've already been contaminated with bacteria. They might become a little more tart over time. And if you you'll find mold growing on the surface. By the way, you can just scrape the mold off to maybe an inch, throw out about the top inch of yogurt and you're fine, because the bacteria in the yogurt are also protecting the yogurt from the mold. But things eventually will develop off odors and flavors. And obviously you can tell when produce is no good, because you just basically look at it and sniff and maybe taste a tiny bit and see if it's okay. The bitter taste of oxidized oil, that is, if you eat large quantities of oxidized oil, you have some free radicals wandering around, but you're going to have those anyway. Here's something important. You can't always rely on your senses. And the big one for that is moist foods served straight from the fridge without cooking. So what am I talking about? I'm talking about lunch meat. And believe the use-by date on your lunch meat and be very careful about storing deli meats where you just really don't know how when you bought it and it's been sitting there in a Ziploc for a while. It's also really important to make sure that the refrigerator is low enough. The refrigerator temperature should be like 35 to 40 degrees. And so that brings up hotel fridges, because I was in a hotel recently. Don't store stuff for more than a few hours or overnight in a hotel fridge if it qualifies as lunch meat or cold cuts. If you want, if you've got a lot of turkey breast in there, you can cook it, slices of turkey breast, bring it to 165 degrees, and it's just fine to eat. You will have gotten rid of the stuff that might make you sick. Those use-by, best-by dates, those are influenced by big food. And so what we want is to change the label to best if used by for quality. And if you do need a safety, use by. But forget this sell-by dates because it's confusing. Next year, California, once more, leading the nation, will simplify its laws. And I can't wait. We've got enough confusion and they finally got the nutrition labels more or less right. Flaxseed, well, you know, I just want to say one last thing. Freeze your flaxseed, grind it, and then eat it. Don't let, it's particularly ground flaxseed, sit around in the fridge because that oxidizes and loses all the properties you're taking it for. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.